fly to Germany to talk with Dominic Baer. He is an MVP in Visual Studio and has been so since 2005. We get to meet with him to talk about identity and access control protocols. Also, we get to explore Heidelberg, his hometown, and take a look at all of his surroundings. Hey, I'm Seth Juarez, and I'm in Heidelberg, Germany, and it's freezing cold. We're about to meet Dominic Baer and learn all about identity, and it's really cold. So, here he is. Dom, are you home? Are we in the right spot?
Hello.
Dom, how are you, my friend?
Man, Seth.
It's been a long time. It's been a long time. It's been what, a couple years?
It feels like years.
Yeah, it does. Well, why don't you show us your office, my friend?
Yeah, come on in.
All right, so this is like Cribs, but like dev style. Look at this car. This is what he drives to work. It's pretty cool. I saw a tweet of your cool office, so I'm pretty excited about it. Let's take a look. All right, dude.
Come on in.
This is an awesome office you got going on here.
Thank you.
And this this is what heats it up, huh? Because it's freaking cold here.
It is coldish today.
Coldish? Does it get colder than
that? Yeah, it does, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So tell me about your crib, man.
We just moved in here like a half a year ago, and the main reason I fell in love with this house is because of this room.
Right.
So I wanted to have an extra room where I can keep, you know, stuff from the past, my records, you know, whiskey, fireplace, pictures, you know, a second monitor.
Nice, second monitor, this is awesome.
Things like that.
Well, cool, man, I love your office.
Thank you.
All right, so why should I be taking a look at Identity Server? What is it?
So Identity Server, technically speaking, it's a so-called security token service, which is a bit of an abstract term. But it helps you implement things like single sign-on and single sign-out and API access control and kind of things. So I think the important point is it's a framework that allows you to build that stuff yourself, as opposed to like a box product, so to speak, yeah? So this all started really as a hobby project, I think back in the .NET 3.0 timeframe, when there was this thing released called the Windows Identity Foundation,
right?
So which for the very first time gave a developer access to all of this complicated stuff like WS Federation and WS Trust. And so I started building a couple of these token services for customers, and then I kind of started to see the grand scheme, kind of like in Matrix, you know, when you start making sense of the green stuff. So I basically thought, okay, I realized that most of the time a token service works to 80% like that, and the 20% are like customizations you make for certain scenarios. So I built this thing called Starter STS on CodePlex.
Yeah, that's a long time ago.
Yeah. And then from that, it became Identity Server 1, which was built on web forms, right? And then a couple of years later, you know, web forms wasn't the hotness anymore.
Right.
So then Brock Allen came along and we rewrote the thing for MVC. And then maybe 3 years ago, we rewrote the thing again for Katana. Mm-hmm. And
with the Owen stuff, right?
And as middleware. Mm-hmm. And now, as of today, we are kind of like very, very close, like 2 weeks before we're going to release for ASP.NET Core.
Which is the newest stuff, which works on Linux and Windows and stuff.
Yeah, you know, like in Germany, we have this saying, like when you're building a house, like the first house you build is for your enemy. The second house you build is for a friend,
uh-huh.
And the third one you want to live in.
That's right, because by that time, you already know how to build it, right?
So that's a bit of like with token services, yeah? So 3 was really good. With 4, I think we are really hitting the sweet spot now between taking away the hard things from developers, so they don't need to understand the protocols, like, you know, they don't need to read the specs. I mean, it would be good if they would read them, but it's not a requirement to get started, but giving them still enough flexibility to implement all these scenarios, because I think that's That's where it all came from. We realized that a box product, you name them, yeah, they only can solve like 85% mm-hmm. of the use cases, and then you're hitting a limit and you can't go on. And that's why we decided to build as a framework. So you are building your own identity server if you like,
right.
but we are making it really easy for you, and you just have to fill in the blanks, like, you know, your look and feel and to which database you're connecting and all that stuff, which is typically different for every single installation.
So you implemented this thing over and over and over again for various and sundry clients, and you're like, I should probably just write this once, and then you keep using that for your clients, and then other people can now use it as well. Is that about the sum of it?
Yeah, I mean, it all started with implementing the hard stuff and letting people make some changes to, you know, to be good enough for their scenarios. But also over time, the other interesting thing is that the protocols have changed, right? I mean,
right.
like when I started, it was all about web single sign-on, and then it was WCF, right? And for the last 5 years, I would say, it's all about, you know, what people call modern applications. It's all about APIs and mobile and JavaScript and yeah. So the latest incarnation of Identity Server is all about the two most important protocols here, which are OpenID Connect and OAuth.
So you mentioned scenarios. I mean, I'm trying to get my head around, okay, what scenarios does this solve? Do you have like one or two basic
sure.
scenarios that could help us out?
I mean, I guess there are a couple of observations how we build applications today, right?
Sure.
So if that's the server side, yeah, the two things you're building today are either web apps, right?
Uh-huh.
Or you're building web APIs.
Right.
Right?
I mean, that's where we're at nowadays.
Exactly. Yeah. So the other observation is now, which is maybe different to where we started a couple of years. We know, like, with WIF, it was all the assumption, or with the full .NET framework, it was all the assumption you are on Windows, right? You have the luxury of having this operating system.
They are.
Well, and also the luxury of all these rich APIs, you know, that's why they came up with these enormously complex things like XML, digital signatures, mm-hmm. and, you know, like something that you can't implement yourself, and it's hard to find libraries for that on other platforms that are not .NET Framework,
sure.
for example, yeah? So, you know, it's kind of like coming back to least common denominator technologies in a good way. That work everywhere. So if it works on a phone, it will work on a Windows computer.
Right.
But if it works on a Windows computer, it doesn't necessarily work on a phone,
mm-hmm.
right? So we have many, many different clients now these days, yeah? So let's do this. We have browsers, right? Browsers.
Right.
So, and browsers, you know, maybe they, you know, talk to web applications, you know, just opening a URL and
sure.
that's easy. But we also have JavaScript now running here, right? And they
yeah.
may talk directly to these guys, right? These guys might talk this way as well, yeah?
So it's a fun graph now.
And it gets more exciting.
Okay.
So, you know, like, let's take the universally accepted symbol for a telephone.
Right, of course.
Yeah. Or a tablet, or, you know, a laptop computer, yeah? They talk like this, okay? So now we have humans as well, okay?
Yeah.
So this human might use a browser to talk to this, or he might use a phone or a tablet or a computer, or even he might during the day, you know, at work time use his laptop, and then he goes on the train and takes his phone out, and in the evening he uses his tablet or whatever. Yeah, so you have the same user here talking to maybe the same backend but using different clients.
Sure.
Okay, so there's also a very explicit distinction between the two. So users, I like to call them the carbon-based life forms
yeah.
in your system, whereas these guys are the silicon-based life forms. So the users and clients,
mm-hmm.
yeah? And obviously, from a security point of view, the rules in a browser are fundamentally different as they are on an Android device or on an iOS device or on, you know, or on a laptop computer or
sure.
whatever, yeah? And the last interesting one is, you know, servers or like headless devices. Yeah, like things, you know, things.
Yeah, like the Internet of Things,
yeah.
right? Okay, I got it.
Either that or, you know, like one data center process calling an API, right? There's no user involved here. It's just this, machines talking to each other.
Sure.
Yeah. So how does that work? Yeah. And you know, and now there might be more APIs involved here. Yeah. So you want to maybe call like this.
So this is a huge headache. Like when I did a MVC a long time ago, when it first came out, I just implemented iIdentity and iPrinciple, and there was some session cookie and there was some database. You can't do that here.
No. You know, back in the days, you know, there was this magic checkbox, enable Windows integrated authentication, job done, right? But yeah. this kind of assumed everything was living inside one Active Directory, which isn't the case anymore,
no.
Right? I mean, that might be your Node.js server calling you or, you know, whatever. You name the technology of the day. That might be whatever browser using whatever JavaScript framework. That might be whatever native platform you can imagine, right? And you don't want to build APIs for each of them. You want to build one API,
right?
So to make things even more interesting is, you know, in certain scenarios, you know, this guy might call this guy, and for this here, it's totally good enough to know that he trusts the direct caller. But what about if this API needs to know who is the guy in front of the browser, like in a way that it securely conveyed the identity, right? I mean, like here, you don't trust an iPhone calling you. You want to have assurance that there is your user involved in the transaction.
Yeah. And there might also be things that only this particular user can see, but for some reason it's coming from some other place and you don't know directly who's calling.
So in other words, if you would start implementing security in each of these boxes, it would be a massive complicated system, a massive headache, and you would end up with lots of code duplication or, you know, code that for 90% is copied from here, but because the last 10% need to be different because different use cases and so on. So this is where the STS, the security token service pattern, if you like, comes in.
Okay.
Right? So again, this is nothing new. Looking back at Active Directory, this was called the domain controller. Mm-hmm. Right? But in a Windows world, so to speak, yeah? Whereas the STS is more like a general purpose term. So a domain controller is an STS, right?
Okay.
But an STS is more than just a domain controller.
So we're talking about a token. What is it like? Are you logging on to this and it's giving you something that then you're just passing everywhere?
Exactly. So the STS is a security token service. So its job is, it probably is connected to a user database. So where, for example, you want to store that user information, it might be connected to external providers. Yeah, there might be your Azure Active Directory here or your Google.
Or Facebook,
right?
Or
yeah,
Twitter, right?
Whatever, you name them. Yeah. So all that complexity of talking to these external services is kind of encapsulated here. The idea is that you're now providing authentication as a service.
Okay.
Right, so all of your applications now, yeah, they know, they have a trust here to this guy, right? They trust him. So whatever tokens it issues, as long as they come from the trusted STS, we're good to go. How these tokens get created, how the user gets authenticated, and what other external systems we have to contact to make that happen is not their concern, right? They don't want to know about that.
Like, it's nicer if these people don't have to have, because if you have users all over the place, it's a security problem.
Yeah, yeah, and just imagine, yeah, who writes these APIs? These are not security experts.
Right.
They are business domain experts, right? I mean, they implement their invoicing API or, you know, whatever, yeah? And they don't need to understand or don't have to understand how the protocols work to talk to all these various pieces, right? So yeah, the STS is an abstraction, if you like. It's you know, if you think about service-oriented architecture, that's an authentication service,
okay.
Right? So now the next thing that comes up now is how do these applications talk to the STS? And that's where the protocols come in.
Okay.
Right?
And that's what OAuth and OpenID connect.
Exactly. Yeah, so we have fundamentally two problems here, yeah? One is authentication, right? So we have an application like this guy. He wants to know who is the user. Okay, so you know there's a protocol now how the web application via the browser talks to the STS. The STS sends back a so-called identity token. This thing can be validated, right? And at the end of the day, this can establish a session for that user.
Okay.
Right.
And the token is what's being passed around now, is it? This is who it is.
So for the authentication case, that's OpenID Connect. For web applications, basically, the identity token gets created by the STS. It flows back to the client application. The client validates it. And having a valid identity token proves that this guy could authenticate with the STS.
I see.
Yeah. Again, the big benefit here is this application here doesn't need to know about Google and Facebook and Azure, whatever. That's all encapsulated here. Just the fact that you get back an identity token means, okay, this guy authenticated, and how he authenticated, I don't care. This was fine because our STS took care of it.
When it gets the token from the web app or from the web API, or does it ask the STS, is this a valid token every time?
There are a couple of ways to do that. And there's a second token, which is called the access token. Yeah. So the identity token is the authentication problem. The access token solves the API access problem.
So authorization type thing.
Well, authorization happens not only here, but it's part of it.
Okay.
Yeah. So after you know who the user is, you typically want to delegate the identity of the user to the next hop. Right, and these are APIs typically.
I see.
Yeah. So think of this here. Yeah. Like this guy, he wants to get an access token to talk to the API. Right. So he talks to the STS. He gets back the identity token to make sure the answer is valid. He gets back an access token and then can forward the access token to the API.
The access token says what resources the user has access to. I'm trying to understand the difference between the two.
Okay. So the identity token is for the client application. So the client application wants to know who is the user. So the audience, if you like, for the identity token is the client.
Okay.
Yeah. And what the client is doing is he validates the token and pulls out the claims, you know, like the user ID and whatever, and done. Okay. The access token is for APIs. So the audience is different. Identity token is for the client, access token is for the APIs. So all the client is doing with the access token is it's forwarding it to the next hop it talks to.
I see. Yeah? Kind of fuzzy still. Maybe you can say
so it away. Identity token is for letting the client know who the user is.
Okay.
And the access token is for letting the next hop know who the user is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Obviously, you can add here some logic like saying like, okay, which client is allowed to talk to which API. This is where your authorization, at least your coarse-grained authorization comes in. So you could have like, you know, a rule saying our in-house client can talk to this API, but the third-party client, he can't,
okay,
for example, yeah? Or you are, there's this concept of a consent screen where you show the user like what APIs, what data is the client trying to access? Are you okay with that? And depending on how you do that, you can select and deselect, like give him access to the public data, but not to the private one.
I see. So in Facebook, when I log in through Facebook, it says, is it okay if they see this, this, and this?
Yeah.
They're talking about you hit okay, and what they're doing is they're getting an ID token and an access token that says they have access to those particular things.
The access token basically contains the so-called scopes, they call them, that this token can be used with.
Got it.
Yeah. With GitHub, for example, they have a screen saying, do you want to grant this application access to the public repos and also the private repos? You can select like only public repos for this client, because I don't want to give a third-party client that some source control system that I want to try access to my company private repos, for
right,
example. Yeah. So yeah, this logic is handled by the STS as well.
So the STS actually goes out and gets a token from some of these people. It wraps it and then it sends it back. Is that about right?
You can do that. That here is typically for the authentication part, right? So sourcing an identity, because you know Google doesn't know about your APIs. They only know about their own APIs.
Sure.
Right. So what you typically go out to external systems to get the identity of the user, and then the rules how the access token should be generated is typically happening in your own STS. So that's a very good point. Yeah. So one of the main drivers for Identity Server was that you are building this yourself, mm-hmm. right? Because only you know all of the little details of how APIs work in your context. And we totally encourage people, like even if you're using Azure AD, yeah, put Identisilver in front of it, right? Because you are now controlling your own identity platform, but you can outsource the authentication to a third party.
I see. So sometimes the STS, when you go here, is literally offloading the authentication to someone else.
It becomes invisible, if you like, yeah? But again, the very important point is all your applications know about is this one STS.
Yes, which makes it a lot easier to manage.
And if you add a new authentication method here, they don't need to know, right? I mean, that's all handled here. Yeah, and if you only have one of them, let's say Azure ID, then you just make it an invisible forwarder, if you like. So you send the user to Azure ID, he logs in, he might already have single sign-on already because his machine is joined, whatever.
Sure.
He comes back to Identity Server. Now we can run all of, because it's a framework, you can write C# code to make everything happen. Yeah, and then what's inside of here is totally in your control. Whereas with AD, you are not in control of the contents of the tokens.
I see.
Yeah.
And that way you can sort of have homogeneity when it comes to what's in the tokens across all of your resources.
And, you know, even if you might, maybe, you know, you decide one day, I don't want to use Azure AD anymore. I want to go to Google Apps, right? Then all you need to do is change the integration at this point here, but all your applications are unaffected by that.
Dominic was gracious enough to spend an additional 90 minutes diving into the OpenID Connect protocol and how someone could literally create their very own token service using Identity Server 4. We felt this was such important content that we decided to release each video as standalone pieces. Well, this is awesome, man. So we went through and we saw client authentication, right, through the back channels as well. We also saw logging in via an external app, and then we saw adding Google to that whole mix as well.
Yep.
This has been awesome, man. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right, why don't we go see Heidelberg a little bit?
Yeah, it's actually a really nice weather today.
All right, let's go.
Let's go. So we are here at the Vetter's Brauhaus, which is a brewery and a restaurant. And it's one of the few breweries left in Heidelberg, actually. It's a shame. Like the local ones, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, and here you can, you know, it looks pretty original.
Yeah.
They brew at night, have the restaurant by day. And that's the four beers they do here. So that's a blonde,
uh-huh.
Yeah, light blonde. That's a dark wheat beer. That's a seasonal beer, I'm not sure, and that's actually their specialty. I think in 1994, this was the strongest beer in the world. Obviously, in between, other breweries did other things, but yeah, it's 11.5%.
Holy cow.
Which is not a lot anymore.
Right.
But 20 years ago, it was quite a bit.
I've gotten a freshly brewed Diet Pepsi, original from Heidelberg.
Knock yourself out, yeah.
It's delicious. Refreshing. And then we're getting some other food later on, right?
We'll get geese and duck and sausages. And
so how long have you been an MVP?
I think it's my 14th year now.
14 years?
Yeah.
Like, I'm 15 years old, and so you've been an MVP from almost my whole life.
Exactly.
So how did you get involved with the program?
So when I left my company, as I told you, I was starting to look for new things. So, and by the time, the hottest thing to do in .NET was going to Develop Mentor, which was a training company.
That's right.
By the time, yeah, like Don Box and
yeah.
The people that started Pluralsight afterwards. Yeah.
Okay.
Like, so I applied for a job there, and they had a guy called Keith Brown, and he was like the security guru.
Mm-hmm.
Like, by the time, he know everything about Windows security, basically. And so I was applying for exactly teaching this course, and I got it in the end, which was pretty involved. They had like test teachers and pretty scary interviews and everything. And then I think Keith, who was an MVP by the time, so you can recommend
I
other
see.
People.
Yeah.
So he recommended me, and then I think 1 or 2 years later, someone wrote me an email that, yeah, you want to be an MVP? I mean, I was hanging out a lot on forums and, you know, mailing lists by the time.
Yeah. Wow, that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And so you've been an MVP continuously for 14 years.
In the developer security, which was brand new by the time.
I see.
And it's still an interesting group because we only have like maybe 30 people in that group. So it's not like, you know, the ASP.NET MVP group,
yeah,
where they had like
huge.
300 people or something. So whenever we get together, it's actually pretty interesting because you can get like product people into the room and just talk to a bunch of people, actually, yeah, like having face-to-face Q&As, and so yeah, that's quite nice.
Well, awesome. And how do you like the program so far?
So I think it changed a lot over the years. I think for me, at the beginning of my career, it was very, very useful to be able to write emails to Redmond.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that you can ask your MVP lead to introduce you to someone. And, you know, times were so different. There wasn't any open source, right? I mean, I learned the .NET framework from Reflector.
Right, of course.
I decompiled the source code and we decompiled ASP.NET made IIS loaded, and so we can step through the source code with the debugger,
wow.
Stuff like that, yeah. So times were different. Today it's much easier to interact with the actual developers,
right.
But 15 years ago they were like behind an iron curtain, kind of, yeah. You didn't know their names and their email addresses, and so yeah, it was really, really useful. I've only been a couple of times, or actually only once, to the MVP Summit, but I like that a lot for the same reasons.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's a useful program. Yeah.
Well, awesome, dude. Cheers, my friend.
Enjoy your
freshly brewed Pepsi Light. All right, man, we just had some awesome dinner, but I smelt some really good stuff over there. What's this going on back there?
There's all kinds of desserts.
Oh, yeah! So what is this setup that we got going on over
there? So that's a Christmas market. It's pretty traditional German setup. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a carousel.
Of course. Are we going to ride the little kiddie train? Are we allowed to?
You can if you want
to.
Good.
Okay.
We'll have spiced wine. That's,
okay.
That's a big thing here.
Okay, okay.
And, you know, all kinds of sweets, like roasted almonds.
I'm super excited.
Stuff.
And do they sell, like for the Christmas market, is that where you go to buy stuff for Christmas for people? Or
no.
It's just
I mean, you can. You know, like, they have, you know, candles and stuff like that.
Awesome. Well, yeah, candles, I mean, is that something you buy a lot of? Or is
yeah,
it
yeah, daily.
Oh, of course, of course. All right, so let's go.
Yeah.
All right. All right, we are here in the busy Christmas market.
One of the many we have, yeah.
So tell us what this is.
So that's basically, this opens 1st of December and goes on till the 24th of December. And, you know, it's all about Christmas, as you can see.
Yeah, of course.
So they have, you know, they have sweets and spiced wine and, you know, roasted almonds, waffles, pancakes, like all, you know, desserts, basically.
You had me at waffles, man.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's go.
Let's go.
Oh, but there's a card. We don't want to get killed.
Let's go now?
No, not yet. Okay, now let's go. All right, dude, so what is this? Tell me about the menu.
Sugar, chocolate.
Like it.
Strawberry, caramel.
No, are we getting waffles?
Yes.
Okay. So tell me again. So sugar.
Uh-huh. Sugar with cream.
Uh-huh.
Chocolate.
Uh-huh.
Strawberries.
Okay.
Caramel.
Okay.
Cherry.
I feel like
apple.
I want all of them.
I want caramel.
Okay, caramel, and I will get chocolate.
Eine Waffel bitte mit Schokosauce, eine mit Karamell bitte.
Aber auch mit Sahne, ne?
Ja. Alles mit Sahne.
I'm so excited.
So you're getting chocolate with cream.
Yes. Yes. All right, so they make it here then?
Right here.
Okay, all right. Look at that goodness. Thank you very much.
Take the fork first.
So you're not getting it all over your face?
You can.
But I don't have any on my face.
No.
All right, your turn. All right, Dom, it's been so cool to be with you here in Heidelberg, my
friend.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks for having me. And you know, it's a little cold here. There's something you can do about that.
Yeah, let's go home.
All right, dude. We'll see you later.
See
you. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Next on the MVP show, we head to Cambridge to visit postdoctoral researcher at MRC Cancer Unit at the University of Cambridge, speaker and Microsoft MVP, Evelina Gabasova. We also had the chance to explore Cambridge, a university city, and the county town of Cambridgeshire, England, on the River Cam, about 50 miles north of London. The University of Cambridge was founded in 1209, a year after I was born. It is one of the top five universities in the world. I was lucky to stop in so she could drop the knowledge on data science and educate me on an awesome data exploratory feature on Azure, among other things. Stay tuned.